I think we're living in a post-truth world and not a post-modern world anymore. Postmodernism says there's no such thing as truth. But post-truth mindsets say truth is important, but only insofar as it feeds and satisfies my feelings and my preferences. So truth exists, but I don't care unless it happens to comport with what I like. And how do we respond into a world that doesn't deny that truth exists? It just denies that truth is important.
5 centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Hey there, welcome to another edition of the White Horse Inn. I'm Shane Rosenthal. On this program, we're airing part two of my conversation with Abdu Murray, who is a convert to the Christian faith from a Muslim background, and who is the author of Grand Central Question, Saving Truth, and more recently, Seeing Jesus from the East, which he co-wrote with Ravi Zacharias. Here are some highlights from last week's conversation with Abdu Murray.
I was raised as a Muslim, as a Shiite Muslim, and I believed that people should believe true things and not false things. I thought Islam was true, and therefore the things that were contradictory to Islam were therefore false. So I began to reach out to people who weren't Muslims and show them why they were wrong and I was right. And I would engage with Christians and I would ask them the question, why are you a Christian? And they would say something along the lines of, well, I guess I'm a Lutheran because we go to church at a Lutheran church on Christmas and Easter, so I'm a Lutheran. And they would even say it like that. It sounded like a question more than it did like an answer. So I would ask them, are you sure? Because I'm not sure you know. But then I'd say something like this. Are you telling me that tradition is the reason you believe something, that you trust your eternal soul to a religious system that someone else has thought through? Have you thought it through yourself? And the answer was usually no. And I'd say, well, great. Well, I thought it through for you. Here's 15 reasons why you're wrong.
Interesting.
Well, along the way, though, there were some Christians who actually knew what they were talking about and who not only responded to my challenges, but had a few challenges of their own that they would lodge my way. And that started me thinking that maybe this Christian faith isn't as easy to debunk as I once thought. So I was reading the Bible to try to find a contradiction, a systemic contradiction. This is in my college days, reading the Bible to find a big contradiction, like something that, like, you know, Jesus says in Luke X, and then he says in Matthew or John, not X, something completely different. And it was fundamental to the message because this Bible I thought was corrupted. Muslims believe that the Bible was once God's word, but became corrupted over time.
Right.
And I thought, well, this is a corrupt book, but it's making so much sense. And it challenged me. In all the times I had asked Christians, why are you a Christian? And they would say tradition. They never asked me, why are you a Muslim? And the reason was because I didn't give them a chance to. I would begin to launch into my reasons why they were wrong. And had they asked me, I probably would have given them a million, you know, little evidences for why I thought Islam was true and all that. But the real reason would have been tradition, the very reason I was chiding them for having. So this got me thinking, maybe I should examine these faiths side by side and every other ism and schism that's out there with an objective view. Not just swallow wholesale the arguments for and the arguments against Christianity or Islam, as it were, but really see what holds up to scrutiny. Now, I was totally confident Islam would win the day, but I wanted to be as objective as I possibly could. Well, over the course of years, I began to study these things, and I began to see the mounting evidence in favor of the Christian faith, that the Bible has been faithfully transmitted down through the centuries. That in that Bible, Jesus says he's the Son of God who takes away the sins of the world by dying on a cross. And then he rises from the dead to prove that he was right.
Well, Abdu Murray is back with us for this program. In 2018, he released a book titled Saving Truth, Finding Meaning and Clarity in a Post-Truth World. So Abdu, in a nutshell, what's this book about?
Yeah, in a nutshell, it is on the whole idea of a post-truth world and how do we respond into a world that doesn't deny that truth exists. It just denies that truth is important. I think we're living in a post-truth world, not a post-modern world anymore. I think postmodernism has died its death, but from the ashes of postmodernism isn't the idea that truth is important. It's a post-truth idea. So the fundamental distinction here is this, is that postmodernism says there's no such thing as truth. But you can reason with someone like this. In fact, I heard Greg Kokel on the radio reasoning about why postmodernism is false, because it's self-defeating. When you say there's no such thing as truth, that statement's either true or it's false. And if it's true, then there is truth. And if it's false, then why did you say it? These kind of things. But post-truth doesn't say there's no such thing as truth. Post-truth mindsets say truth is important, but only insofar as it feeds and satisfies my feelings and my preferences. So truth exists, but I don't care unless it happens to comport with what I like.
Yeah, you write that we don't care about the truth if it gets in the way of our personal preferences. In this soft mode of post-truth, the truth exists objectively, but our subjective feelings and opinions matter more.
Yeah, and that's difficult because you say, how do you talk to somebody who looks at you and might even nod politely, or nowadays not so politely, at your claims you're making? When you give them facts, evidence, reason, and logic, and they look at you and say, yeah, but none of that matters because I feel like this. And they're like, okay, I hear what you're saying. I can even acknowledge what you're saying is true. Doesn't matter. How do you actually talk to that person? So saving truth is about pointing out the consequences of a post-truth mindset, because we're increasingly a pragmatic society. Tell me what works. I'll believe what works. I'll do what works. Well, if you can expose that post-truth thinking doesn't work, then people will go away from it. And then what are they left with? Well, they're left with the truth. And so what I try to point out is the confusion and the culture of confusion we're in, how it leads to chaos, and how clarity about ideas of human freedom, dignity, sexuality, pluralism, science and faith, how clarity will lead us ultimately to a sense of fulfillment that comports with reality as we know it.
You also say that if the evidence fits our preferences and opinions, then all is well and good. If it doesn't, then the evidence is deemed inadmissible or offensive, with offense being a kind of solvent against an otherwise sound argument. That reminds me of one of the events we find in the Gospels when the disciples came to Jesus and they said, did you know that the Pharisees were offended by what you said? And he just simply responds to them saying, pay no attention to their offense. They're blind guides. You know, so that idea of offense, of being offended, is nothing new, really, but it's simply something that appears to be increasing as our culture becomes more influenced by feelings rather than truth. Would you agree?
I totally would agree. In fact, as I pointed out, offense is the universal solvent, because what it does is that it insulates me from actual argument and actual engagement. If I can simply say, I'm offended by what you said, and you'll notice something too. When it comes to various claims, everything becomes either racially insensitive, sexually insensitive, socially insensitive in some way, religiously insensitive, and it becomes more and more subtle or even a stretch to say, really, that's insensitive? How is that possibly insensitive? And the reason is because if I can label you as an offensive person, well, then I can shut you out.
Right.
I can completely discount every argument you have so that when you bring facts and evidence and reason, I don't have to become uncomfortable anymore. You see, I think we've equated being uncomfortable with being offended.
Exactly.
And that isn't the same thing. The truth is supposed to make you uncomfortable. It's supposed to challenge our views. All of us, whether Christian or non-Christian, believe it or not, we all have faulty views. And when the evidence comes against those views and the truth smacks us in the face, we're supposed to be uncomfortable, because without the discomfort, we won't grow and change. But offense becomes the solvent that prevents a sound argument from being entertained.
Yeah, you talk about the problem of the confirmation bias, that a lot of us, instead of searching for the truth, we're actually more interested in confirming what we already believe, so that things that we hear from the outside, if we're listening, end up just making us feel uncomfortable. That's the way it works. When other things that don't comport with what we already assume to be true, it just kind of causes us pain. And when you experience that discomfort, it's actually a moment to have some self-realization that, wait a minute, this is a different worldview, a different idea. Let's think it through instead of reacting emotionally.
Yeah, and you know, I can speak from experience on this. You know, before I chide the world for being post-truth, I got to remember something. I was once very post-truth. You know, I believed in truth. I thought Islam was true. I thought other things were false. And I said, I'll go where the evidence leads. But it took me 9 years to become a Christian, because for the longest time, my preference was that either this worldview of Christianity isn't true, or I can syncretize it with Islam so I don't have to make a decision. And so I was quite post-truth. I claimed truth was important, but I knew my preferences and my feelings mattered more. So before I chide the rest of the world for this, I have to recognize this instinct within myself. But yeah, I think that the role of feelings has been so romanticized and so lionized as a virtue that we say words like, let me tell you my truth.
Right.
What they really mean is my perspective. So this can be valid if understood from perspective. So let's say you have a victim of sexual assault and someone says, I wanted you on the show today so you can speak your truth. What they mean is tell your story. But what the culture has now transformed that into is that I can tell my truth in terms of how I feel sexually, how I feel in a gender sense, how I feel in a religious sense. And because it's quote unquote my truth, it becomes sacralized. It becomes sacrosanct. You dare not challenge my truth. But why? Because each individual person is no longer a free individual. They are an autonomous individual. And that is a different state of affairs. Freedom and autonomy are not the same thing. And we become gods in our striving for autonomy.
Yeah, that could be a whole program in itself. But in your book, you talk about a conversation that you had in an empty auditorium with a young adult who began having doubts about the faith he was raised in. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, absolutely. This is such a unique story. So I was speaking at a place where a lot of Christians were. It was a camp. And there's a lot of Christians who come to it, and they come to it with, with a long tradition of family going there. And this young man was going to the camp every single year, and he loved going there because he liked the people. But he had become an atheist a year or so, maybe even a little bit longer before that. And so I talked to his parents, and I asked, well, what happened? And they said, well, he would come to us with questions. He would ask us questions. And we said, son, we don't question here. We don't doubt. The Bible says it. I believe it. That settles it, kind of a thing. And I did say to them, I said, can I make a comment to you? And I mean it with all the respect I can muster, honestly, is that if you want to help your son become an atheist, that's a good way to do it. Because he's coming to you with questions. And everyone gets answers to their questions from somewhere. It's either going to be you or the internet atheists or whoever it might be. So they said, but you know what he's been doing? He's been coming to your apologetics classes in the morning. And he's really interested in what you have to say. He wants to talk to you. Would you talk to him? I'm like, of course I would talk to him. Absolutely. So the evening chapel service was over. The auditorium had cleared out. And me and this young man sat down. And I asked him a question. I said, so what are your big hangups with the Christian faith? And he launched into a couple of objections he had. You know, evolution disproves a need for God. The Bible's been changed so many times you can't believe it. The Bible condones slavery. And he went on with a litany of things. So, well, that's a lot. What are the three big ones? The ones that if you had this resolved, you would move the needle forward in terms of believing in God. He listed those. And so I asked him a question. I said, well, where'd you get this from?
Crucial question.
Right. I said, what books have you read? He said, well, I don't really read books. I watch videos. Okay, well, what videos have you watched? It was all YouTube. And believe it or not, Comedy Central. Like, are you telling me that you've come to your opinions about God's existence from a channel that literally has the word comedy in the title? Really? You haven't read one book on it? Can you name for me any Christians you've read who've responded to the objections you've heard? Well, none. Or even any videos, none. This is one of the first times you'd ever heard a Christian actually respond to any of these objections. So my question back to him was, do you want atheism to be true? Or are you curious if there's a God? Because it sounds like you want atheism to be true, judging from the fact that you haven't read any Christian responses to this stuff. Mm. You've just simply swallowed everything atheists have told you. And you've swallowed it from the least critical thinking atheists. A lot of great atheists you should be reading, and none of the ones that you've read are them. Well, we had an amazing conversation. It was long, it was good. And I said, any questions more? He's like, no, you've answered pretty much everything. Wow, I got a lot of thinking to do. Well, I saw the parents and they said, this has moved the needle significantly. Only because, not because I'm so eloquent and so bright. That's not the reason. I hope it's not the reason, my goodness, because if that's the reason, we're all in trouble. It's because he longed to have questions actually answered. And I also did challenge his motivation. I think he wanted to buck the system. And when you challenge that, I think people actually start to realize their own biases and their own confirmation biases. And it was a fruitful discussion after that because of that.
Yeah, I think when it comes to young adults, especially those who are raised in the faith, there's kind of an assumption that this is the faith that your parents are handing you. And it's just assumed to be true in the family. But often, especially in an environment where, you know, you kind of have the Bible says it, I believe it, that settles it, kind of a working theology. It's not okay to ask questions because that's sort of like voicing your doubt. And that's where young adults leave. But one thing that I find fascinating is the very Bible itself never states things that way. You look at the opening of Luke. It's here's why, Theophilus, you can have certainty about these things. I've carefully investigated them. I've talked to the eyewitnesses. He doesn't say, I am God's mouthpiece, therefore God said it, you should believe it. Even if you look at Deuteronomy, it's like, why should I believe the future prophets? Here are the ones that you should believe, the ones who speak the things that come to pass. In other words, you evaluate what the prophet said and compare it to real history, and it has to correspond to reality. You don't believe the prophet if he isn't speaking things that correspond to reality. And so that seems to me that we need to do more work there, especially with our young.
I definitely think that that's the case. And to portray the Bible as the kind of book that actually welcomes questions.
Right.
It even welcomes doubts. Take a look at two examples. There's a lot more examples, actually, but there's two examples that jump out to me in Jesus' own life. John the Baptist. So here's John the Baptist. Here's the story. He, you know, stands up to the authorities and says, you've done wrong and all these things. He's thrown in prison. Well, while he's languishing in prison, what does he do? He sends disciples to Jesus, the very one who he baptized and the one who he said, whose shoes he's not even worthy to untie. He sends his disciples to Jesus and they say, are you the one who's to come? Or should we wait for another? In other words, I'm not so sure you're the guy after all. Why? Not because the evidence isn't there, because John the Baptist is going through it. And what does Jesus do? He doesn't say, you tell John the Baptist, I feel so betrayed by that lousy so-and-so, that naysayer, that faithless fool. Tell him, no. What he says is, you tell John what you see and hear. Go give him the evidence. The blind see, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the good news is preached to the poor. He rewarded John the Baptist's sincere doubt with evidence. And then you have, of course, Thomas. Thomas doesn't want to believe until he sees and feels the scars in Jesus's body. Well, he had the eyewitness testimony, the evidence already of his friends. And then Jesus says, you know, you believe because you see, but there are those who will believe who do not see, not because it's blind faith, but because they have the eyewitness testimony. They have the evidence. And Jesus doesn't say, now, Thomas, I'm done with you. Thomas is so enthralled that he goes and he is martyred, tradition says, in India, near Chennai, which, by the way, is predominantly Christian even to this day. Mm-hmm. So doubt isn't a bad thing if it leads us to answers. The difference I would say, Shane, is that it's one thing to be a skeptic. It's another thing to be a cynic. You see, a skeptic is someone who won't believe until there's enough evidence. A cynic is someone who won't believe even when there is. And the trick is, do your doubts lead to skepticism that leads to faith, or do your doubts lead to cynicism that leads to a dismissal of all things that could lead us to God?
Yeah, always questioning, but never arriving at any truth.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, so now let's talk about your most recent book, Seeing Jesus from the East, which you co-wrote with Ravi Zacharias. First of all, Abdu, what is this book about? And why should Westerners care how Easterners see Jesus?
Yeah, so this book is, the title says a lot about it, is this recapturing the Easternness of Jesus. And the reason why Westerners should care, and frankly why everyone should care, but one reason why Westerners should care about how Easterners see Jesus is that there is this narrative stream, as it were, that says that Jesus is the icon of white imperialistic, colonialistic, baptized dominance.
Yeah.
You know, that somehow once Constantine became emperor of Rome and once he got converted, that Rome became a Christian nation or a Christian empire, and that was used to dominate Africans and that led to the colonialization that happened in Europe and all these things. The reality is that all the bad of the Roman Empire was influenced for the good by the Christian faith. And we tend to forget that. We think of Jesus as this white icon of imperialistic Western religion, when the reality is that olive oil drips from every page of the New Testament and from the Old, that the curries and the spices and the cumins of the conversations and what's going on is so prevalent in the Bible that we can recapture the authenticity that Jesus is, in fact, not an icon of white religion, but he is a universal icon for faith. So there's an Easternness to him that goes against the stream. But the other reason is that in order to understand some of the puzzling things Jesus seems to say, or the seemingly puzzling things he says, is that if you understand the Eastern context in which he actually moved and breathed and acted and ministered, you'll get a richer understanding of the most influential figure in all of history. So I think that that's super important for us as Westerners to see. And the flip side of this is that Jesus not only believed in the importance of the collective, being from an honor-shame culture, but he never valued the collective over the individual's dignity. And so he would buck tradition when it meant he would vouchsafe the dignity of the individual, which is a very Western thing to do. So Easterners and Westerners alike can see something in the person of Jesus.
You say that in the West, familiarity and complacency have diluted the gospel's Eastern tang. You know, I have found in my own study that as I challenge my assumption of what a given text says, if I'm going to teach a Bible study or preach a sermon, and I go back and look at how the words were used in that ancient first century Middle Eastern context, wow, things end up opening up for me in ways that I've never seen after 30 years of study. And I like what you say there, that familiarity and complacency have diluted the message for us. Talk about that a little bit.
I think that that's true. It's so funny because let me give you two quick examples of where we can get so much depth of meaning and even respond to an objection if we understand Jesus in his Eastern context. So people have said oftentimes that Jesus isn't so much a liberator of women. He's a bit of a sexist or a bit of a bigot. They take the Canaanite woman who approaches him and asks Jesus to heal her daughter. And Jesus says something like, it's not right for the meat meant for the children to be given for the dogs. In other words, we're Jews and we're superior and you shouldn't have this as a Canaanite woman. And it seems so bigoted and so sexist. And she sort of puts him in his place. She says, but even the scraps on the table, the dogs eat those. Now, this is interesting because if you understand the way Middle Easterners actually speak then and today, you'd recognize this is not sexist nor bigoted in the slightest bit. Jesus is doing a common Middle Eastern thing in that he's engaging in the kind of banter that would stick in the minds, not only of the woman who he's speaking to, but of the crowd he's doing this in front of. Recall that his disciples don't like Canaanites either. They were the people who oppressed Israel after they were freed from Egypt, as it were. And certainly not a woman. Don't talk to the rabbi, you know, that kind of thing. They want to shoo her away. So the very fact that Jesus even engages with her in the first place is already evidence of his lack of misogyny and his lack of bigotry. But two, he engages in the banter. He says what the crowd expects him to say, which is, you're the dogs, we're the masters. And then he uses her to turn it around because he then says about her, not so great of faith have I found in all of Israel kind of a thing. He elevates the faith of a Canaanite, non-Jewish woman above the faith of the bigots within his own ranks. And so rather than this being an example of Jesus's bigotry towards women and towards different ethnicities, this is actually evidence that Jesus isn't a bigot and he wants to teach the crowd around him to not be this way. If you understand the way Middle Easterners use banter to prove a point, you'll see the depth of that. Then, of course, the other example I would give really quickly is a parable that we often, again, with the complacency that we have, we read it and don't see, I think, some of the depth. So Jesus lives in an honor and shame culture where the perception of honor and the avoidance of shame is paramount. You see in Matthew chapter 20, the parable of the generous employer. So the generous employer, he owns a vineyard. And he wants to hire day laborers to come work in his vineyard. And just like today, people are waiting around for work for that day. So he goes and he hires laborers in the first round. But for some reason, the other laborers stick around for a second, third, fourth, even a fifth round of hiring. Now, normally they would have gone home, but these men didn't go home because they did not want to go home in the shame of telling their wives and their children, no food today. I didn't provide today, which would be a terrible shame back then. I remember I wasn't even a Christian when I first read this parable. And the idea of honor and shame leapt out to me. Because what does the parable do? The master keeps coming back and he sees men who are holding out hope that someone will honor them with a day's work. And he gives them all an opportunity. But what does he do? He pays them all the same wage, which seems patently unfair. If you're looking at it from a pure sort of mechanistic Western economic system, you'd say, that's unfair. So the guys who got hired first, who worked the whole day for the same wage as the last guys, they bring it up. They say, wait a minute, you paid these last guys who worked for an hour what you paid me and I worked all day. You owe me more. What is happening here are two things at the same time. One is that Jesus is saying that the master of the vineyard, who is the proxy for God in this parable, honored the faith of the men who waited around all day hoping someone would honor them. He credited their faith as if it was work. And you cannot help but think of Abraham, whose faith was credited him as righteousness in this particular point. He honored them because they wanted to avoid shame, but they knew they couldn't do it on their own. They needed someone else to honor them instead of them honoring themselves. That's one. Honor-shame mentality. When you understand the East, you see this beauty, this richness in that parable. But it's also Western. You know, we have these philosophical conundrums in the West. Easterners are philosophical as well. They're just as philosophical as we are, but it's not as straightforward necessarily. But what is one of the conundrums, right? How can God be sovereign and human beings have free will and accountability? Well, what happens in the parable? The first guys who get hired say, wait a minute, you paid these guys the same amount of money you paid us. And what does the master of the vineyard say? He says, friend, didn't you agree with me using your free will to the denarius? And can't I be generous to who I want to be generous to? God's sovereignty. God's sovereignty, human free will interacting at the same time. So in this one parable, Jesus answers the Eastern mindset of honor and shame and the Western desire to solve the philosophical conundrums we face.
Yeah. In one of your chapters, you tell the story about sitting with an imam who told you that the Bible's unblushing descriptions of the prophet's shameful acts is one of the things that he thought disqualified it as having come from God. Can you tell us a little bit about that engagement and how you responded?
Yeah. So it was one I used to have too. I used to have the same view that the Bible describes people like David and Solomon and even Abraham as morally checkered people. And how can God entrust his message to people who have no integrity or who as we have lapses in integrity? So this is why Muslims believe that the prophets are infallible. They can't be morally fallible. And I pointed out to him, I said, you know, it's interesting you say that because I'm a trial lawyer. And I can tell you this right now, is that whenever a witness comes to the stand and forthrightly tells you their flaws or tells you a part of the story that hurts their case, they become more credible in the eyes of the jury because they're clearly not doctoring the facts.
Right.
They look more credible, not less credible. And the very fact that the Bible, not that the Jews didn't realize, oh my goodness, how do we let this fact about David sneak in here? They knew it was part of the story. The fact that the Bible forthrightly tells you the shortcomings of its most important figures doesn't decrease its credibility. It actually increases its credibility because if the Bible were full of legends, you'd have like a King Arthur type of thing or a Robin Hood type of thing where these men go from pretty good guys to paragons of virtue we should all emulate. That's not what the Bible describes. It describes people who are just like us, broken like us, yet God uses them. So rather than actually showing a shameful side, it shows that God honors those who otherwise would bring shame for their actions, but it gives a credibility to the message we otherwise wouldn't get.
I was once sitting on a plane next to a Muslim from Pakistan, and she found out I was a Christian, and she said, so you Christians are big on mercy, right? I said, yeah, that's a pretty big thing for us. She said, for us Muslim, not so much. And she went on to talk about the fact that, you know, what's more important is obedience to God's commands. So I was trying to figure out a way into the conversation. And ultimately, I came back to the prophet Isaiah, you know, who for us is just as powerful a figure as Muhammad. This is for us a holy prophet of God. And yet he, when he was standing in the presence of God, felt like he was coming undone. And that's why we say mercy is a big thing for us, because even our prophets say we need atonement. And she hadn't heard that before, but that, you know, she had heard Jesus saying, if you look at a woman with lust in your heart, you've already committed adultery. And that's why we wear the burqa. I said, but Jesus also went on to say, if you hate in your heart, you've already committed murder. And she said, no, he doesn't say that. I said, yeah, that's why we need mercy.
Absolutely. You know, it's surprising that she said that because most Muslims, just like a lot of Christians, will believe or think things that are inconsistent with their own scripture. Every chapter of the Quran, except for one, begins with the phrase, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful. So he's called merciful probably more often than anything else. But the reason she says that is because Islam is a law-based system.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because you're trying to draw some parallels between some of Abraham as an example or other people. So it's interesting in the Quran, you see a story where Abraham takes his son up a mountain. They think it's Ishmael. We think it's Isaac, of course. That isn't important. The Quran says he takes his son up a mountain to sacrifice at God's command, to kill his son. and then God stays his hand. Now, what's interesting is in this particular story, in the Quran, it says, meaning in a royal we sense, God says, and we ransomed him, meaning the son, with a momentous sacrifice. So my question is this, what's the ransom for? What's the sacrifice for? If it was merely a test of Abraham's faith to see if he would do it, what's the ransom for? In fact, it's an important Islamic holiday called Eid al-Adha, where they commemorate this whole thing, the sacrifice. So if we don't need God's mercy, and it's not important, then why would Abraham sacrifice his son only to be stopped and then have his son ransomed with a momentous sacrifice? Maybe because even Abraham needs a ransom. Even his son needs a ransom. And that son eventually is ransomed by the son that God himself provides. And I think that's a bridge oftentimes to Muslims as well, because we need to find a God who can balance the idea of mercy, which is getting what you don't deserve,
right,
with justice, which is getting what you do deserve. And God is both maximally just and maximally forgiving or merciful. And how he does both is the cross.
So you say that it's also crucial for Western Christians to learn how Eastern and Middle Eastern Christians have and are enduring pain because of their faith. In the East and the Middle East, you say, being unashamed of the gospel means more than just risking invites to parties, losing job promotions, or not getting into a favorite university. It could also mean loss of freedom and even loss of life. But it also means gaining blessings that are not otherwise attainable. Unpack that a little bit.
Yeah, I think that in the West, we tend to have a little bit more of a comfortable Christianity. It's becoming more and more uncomfortable to be Christian, which is in one sense a good thing. I mean, there's a lot of bad to it as well, but in one sense, it's a good thing because people won't consider us background noise anymore.
Yeah.
What we say will actually matter. It might get yelled at. To quote John Piper, they may yell at it, they may crucify it, but they will not be bored. I think that what's going on in the East, you know, BBC reported that there was a study done on the persecution of Christians outside the West, and they said it's almost a genocide. I'm not sure how it's almost a genocide. It looks like it's deliberately a genocide, but be that as it may, whether it's almost one or is one, the reality is Christians around the world, especially in the East, are suffering a heavy, heavy price for their faith, but it's also the place where the faith is growing the fastest.
Hmm.
Which is just a testimony to the history of Christianity. Wherever it's been oppressed is where it's grown the fastest.
The blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church.
Exactly right. Exactly right. I think that's been true for centuries, and it's still true. I give a story in the book about the 21 Coptic Christians who were killed by the ISIS terrorist group. And you recall the image, right? These Christians come out in bright orange jumpsuits, prison jumpsuits.
Right.
They're kneeling in front of men who are literally robed in darkness. They're all in black, and they're told, if you renounce your faith, you'll be saved. If you don't renounce your faith, you're going to lose your head right now. And all of them cried out to Jesus in that moment, and they all lost their heads. Now, what makes those 21 men so brave? Well, not their own bravery. You know, I remember reading an article. It was an interview of the chief executioner of a country I won't name right now, but he's done a lot of public executions by beheading. And he said that whenever they go to pick up the prisoner to go to the block to be beheaded publicly, no matter how rough, no matter how tough the guy actually is, they always fall to their knees and start to sob because their strength melts away. But why did these Christians not have a strength that melted away? What made them so tough? It wasn't their inner sense of toughness. It was the Holy Spirit. It was Jesus in them that gave them the ability to do what Paul says is to do all things through Christ who strengthens us. It's not just ace the test, get the promotion, save your marriage. That's valid, but it's all things, including face up to your death when it won't end well for you and the ending won't be so happy. And what blessings came from that? One, amplified testimony. Somehow persecution amplifies the testimony beyond. What those 21 men did echoed across the world. They were from villages. They never would have gotten their testimony out, just the convictions of their faith out, had they just lived their lives as normal. And so what these evil men meant for bad, to humiliate these men, God meant to honor them. So amplified testimony. Number two, it's that fulfilled identity, that we identify with Christ in his sufferings, even unto his death. And there's no other way to really get that than by suffering for your faith. And then third, it's an unshakable faith. Is that, you know, many of us wonder, would I be able to withstand that kind of persecution? Well, if you are uncomfortable, for your faith, you'll get a good inclination of just how strong your faith actually is. And the good news is that God gives the strength so that we can have an unshakable faith in light of horrendous circumstances.
Yeah. I just recently interviewed Fikret Bocek, who's a Protestant minister in Turkey. He was raised as Sunni, so he would have been your enemy when you were both Muslims. but he was saying how, you know, under persecution, as they were asking him to recant his faith before beatings, and the people he thought were the strongest ended up saying, there is no God but Allah and Muhammad is his only prophet. And then they would walk out the room. And this guy he thought was weak in the faith ended up being strong and courageous and took the beatings. And then it turned out later he said that the guy he thought was the strongest who had organized the Bible study was just a plant. You know, he was the spy that had them all arrested.
Wow. Wow.
Overturned all of his assumptions.
Wow. Suffering does have a way of enlightening us, doesn't it?
Yeah. It offers some clarity to what are your ultimate convictions and are you willing to face the truth even when it hurts? And then one step further we could go, we could say our Lord says one of the strangest things ever uttered in human history. He says, rejoice in your sufferings. Whoever said that anywhere?
Well, you see that in Acts chapter 2, where the disciples rejoice at their persecution.
Yeah.
And then Paul says this equally bizarre thing. And you can see the consistency, right? Jesus says it, his disciples live it, and Paul lives it out. When he says, for it has been granted to you to suffer. Yeah. In the Greek, that word means lavishly given.
Yeah.
It's a gift. Now, who thinks of that?
Very, very few of us.
It's funny because a guy I was talking to, a good friend of mine, who's done a lot for the Christian faith in terms of giving up his treasure and his time. He's not an apologist or an evangelist in the traditional sense you think of it, but he's a really good man. And he told me, he's like, I'm very uncomfortable by something. I said, what is that? He's like, I've never had to suffer for my faith in any way, shape, or form. I'm like, why does it make you uncomfortable? He's like, because the Bible talks about being uncomfortable for your faith so much. I do wonder, am I living a Christian life? Am I being put in harm's way? I'm like, well, look, I'm not saying you should go into the middle of the square in the most Christian hostile country there is and start preaching Jesus as Lord, but just wait a while. It'll happen.
Yeah, exactly. Well, folks, you've been hearing from Abdu Murray, author of Grand Central Question, Saving Truth, and most recently, Seeing Jesus from the East, which he co-wrote with Ravi Zacharias. Abdu, thanks so much for being with us for these two programs.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. For more information about this program, visit us online at whitehorseinn.org. If you sign up as an innkeeper, architect, or reformer, not only will you get a complimentary subscription to our magazine, Modern Reformation, but you'll also get longer editions of every White Horse Inn broadcast. To find out how to join one of these support programs, click on the support tab of our website, whitehorseinn.org. You can also give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. 7556. We'll see you next time at the White Horse Inn.